Fans, on this Saturday night, it's great to have everyone with us as we look at baseball, and we're going to be joined by Mark Simon of Sports Info Solutions, Mark A. Simon Says on Twitter. But before we do that, I just want to remind everyone about River Islands, and absolutely check out riverislands.com. The floor plans are there, the pictures from the builders, everything is there. They're doing great business out there, and I can't wait to go out there and take a look since I've been back here in the Bay Area. I know Ron Wotus and I want to do it and go out and see Colleen Edwards and the crowd out at riverislands.com. But things are so different here, housing in the Bay Area, with the pandemic, so many people working at home. The schools are a great transition, but good things are happening at riverislands.com. So I'm looking forward to going out there, and you should too. But check them out online, and you can set up an appointment and have a virtual tour and things like that. So riverislands.com. All right, we are joined by Mark A. Simon Says on Twitter, Mark Simon of Sports Info Solutions. Follow him on Twitter, because during the week you're going to get some great stuff, some podcast stuff as well. Mark, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Pretty good, pretty good. And, of course, this is June the 13th, a Saturday, and it is the anniversary of Matt Cain pitching his perfect game against Houston, 10-0, the great plays by Blanco and Arias to end it. Boy, Arias's play, every time I see it, I say, why the heck did he back up on that ball and save Matt Cain? But a couple other no-hitters that I want to talk about, and you can do it any way you want, but Christy Mathewson, the great New York Giant, threw a no-hitter on this date in 1905, the great Christy Mathewson. Mike Scott was someone that I really enjoyed some of the work on MLB Network about the 1986 playoff of the Mets with Houston, and Mike Scott was a big part of that, and Mike Scott threw a no-hitter as well. And the other one is the legend, Doc Ellis, and yesterday's date, June 12th, Pittsburgh Pirates 2-0 over the Padres, a no-hitter. But was that the story? No. He was on LSD, and he walked eight and hit one. And said, boy, those zeros were moving around for me on the scoreboard. So with that preamble, I'm going to let Mark Simon take it away on the no-hitters of some noteworthy people.
Right.
Go ahead.
Let's start with the last one first. So Doc Ellis, like the LSD thing, I'm going to put that on the side just for a sec, because like the next day, that wasn't the story. The story was the no-hitter. There are a couple of things about that one that are interesting. One is that he walked eight, which is too shy of the most in a no-hitter. Jim Maloney walked 10. Eight was the most he ever walked in a start. So I guess if you want to connect that to the moving zeros, I guess that makes sense. 150 pitches, that's like Edwin Jackson territory when we're talking no-hitters. He was in the dugout talking about it the whole time. Fourth inning, he's like, I got one. I got a no-hitter going. The cool thing is there was a good defensive play in this one. Bill Mazeroski made a diving catch in the seventh inning, bruised his knee in the process, but was able to make the play. Matty Alou, a name certainly that the older Giants fans will know. He also made two nice running catches. One of the things that came up, too, was how he grew up in the area of where the Watts riots were in his childhood. And he said, you know, the pressure of pitching in a game like this was nothing compared to seeing tanks outside his house and seeing his mom nearly get shot. So I think that's I know there's the whole LSD thing, and that's been very, for lack of a better word, romanticized. But I like all the other stuff that's connected to that one.
Okay, very good.
Shall I go Christy Mathewson next?
Yeah, absolutely. I like the Doc Ellis story, and that was a good one on the amount of pitches. And I didn't realize that he was that close to Jim Maloney's record of eight walks, and Maloney had 10. But go ahead. Yeah, very good. Good start.
Sure. So Christy Mathewson threw a no-hitter on this date in 1905, which it's that's 115 years ago, which is like ancient baseball history. He faced 28 batters, only one over the minimum. There were two errors in the game, and the way that the newspapers wrote it, they made it very clear that they were like legitimate errors, that it wasn't something that was bogus. The Giants scored their only run in the ninth inning against Three Finger Brown, right fielder George Brown made a running catch that was the most famous play in the game that he turned into a double play to erase one of the two base runners. And the newspaper article said he had everything, including great speed. And before him, the Chicago bunch went down like 10 pins. The game was over in an hour and 25 minutes.
I love it. I love it.
All
no,
right,
it's
Mike
great.
Scott?
Okay, Mike Scott. Yeah, Mike Scott, you know, Roger Craig just couldn't stand him because they always accused him of scuffing the baseball.
Yes. So you're talking to a fan of the 1986 Mets, one of the biggest fans of the 1986 Mets. So it's very difficult for me to talk about Mike Scott with a straight face because I don't like him very much. In 86, he had the incredible season, which I'll get to in a second. Actually, I guess the thing that's most memorable about that game is that he threw it to clinch the division, which doesn't happen for no-hitters. That's one of those one-of-a-kind kind of things. Davey Johnson said that Mike Scott was scuffing the ball, that he had the sandpaper or whatever it was that he was using in his palm, and they would always check the glove. But he had it in his palm, and they wouldn't necessarily check his palm. I'll say simply, I've heard that story from others. I was glad that I read it in a newspaper account, too, because someone else had said that to me, and it makes sense when you think about it that was the way that he could get away with it. Only two pitchers struck out 300 batters in the 1980s, him and Nolan Ryan. And then if you look at 300 strikeouts and an ERA below 2.25, since the DH, him, Pedro, twice, and Clayton Kershaw. That's
wow.
it.
Wow.
One of the great seasons certainly of my lifetime was 1986, but I think it was pretty bogus.
Okay. All right, Mike Scott.
No,
the scuff baseball, but boy, I remember that ball just disappeared, and he did have the no-hitter. Against the Giants to clinch the division. Now, Matt Cain, as I said when we started, Arias, why did you back up on that ball? My God, he almost booted it. And Blanco, of course, the great catch. So your thoughts on Matt Cain? I know we've chatted about him before.
Yeah, well, just to remind people that with the catch, I went through a bunch of no-hitters and tried to find, like, to put values on the plays that were made in those games, like the really improbable ones. And I couldn't find one that was, I know you've got Mark Burley and Dwayne Wise with the perfect game where he goes over the fence
great
to
catch.
Take away a home run. That's in its own kind of like level. But if you look at things that are not that, Gregor Blanco is about as good as it gets. That play had like a 3% head probability. And to make a play when it's a 3%, you either had to like, it almost always takes something like outlandish to happen, like a ball doing something weird. That wasn't. He just made a great route to the ball and just made a great play to get it. And credit to him for doing that, certainly.
Boy, and what a play. I got to see it again, and I know it's on YouTube and everywhere else, but to see Blanco go streaking across the sky like a meteor and putting that glove, it's like Sandy Amoros. I know people may not know 1955 World Series.
Sure.
Dodgers left field put out that glove that was on his right hand because he was left-handed and took a big hit away from Yogi Berra and saved the game for the Dodgers. And that Amoros catch and the Blanco catch sort of blend together for me. So I like it. I'm glad that we could touch on those no-hitters. ESPN, one of your former employers, is doing a big thing on McGuire and Sosa. 1998 and the home run race. Any thoughts on that? I know it's sort of saved baseball, so to speak, with Cal Ripken after the strike, but was it worth it? A fraud? Well, where do you stand on the home run race of 1998? McGuire with 70, Sosa with 66.
Yeah, I remember I didn't particularly like it at the time, and I'll explain why in a second, and I don't like it now, I think for kind of obvious reasons. The idea of cheating and doing what like you could never do without cheating to get to that point. So that's very frustrating for me. The thing that I remember that I didn't like about it then was it took over the games. I went to a Met Cardinal doubleheader in August of 98 where McGuire hit his 50th home run. I looked this up today. And when he hit each of the two home runs that he hit in one of the games, the crowd was louder and more into it than just about any other moment in the game. And this was at Shea Stadium, where the Mets were involved in this race to try and make the playoffs for the first time in 10 years. They came up a little short. They wound up winning the game in the bottom of the ninth inning, which I felt was kind of like justice after all that. And it just, like, irritated me. And then a year later, same thing. McGuire hit two home runs in a game at Shea Stadium, and I was there. One of the home runs hit the scoreboard and hit, like, one of the letters in the out-of-town scoreboard. If you remember how the lights were, the light bulbs, knocked out one of those light bulbs. It was an absurd opposite field home run that you would never, ever see in a million years. And again, the crowd had this buzz to it after it that just, like, irritated me. And to me, it's like the team should be more important than the individual. I understand. I'm probably on the side of this that most people aren't on. But the team should be more important. And the team wasn't more important in those moments. And that kind of irritated me a little bit.
Oh, baseball needed it in 1998. Jason Stark had a short interview with McGuire that he posted. Did you see it, where you asked McGuire, you know, could you have done this without PEDs? And McGuire says, absolutely. Once I got in the box, I was focused. Well, look, as a rookie, hit 48, you know, as a skinny rookie when he came up. So he had that kind of power. And, of course, like Bonds, you know, the power was accentuated once the PEDs got involved, allegedly.
Yeah, 49's not 70 or 66, though. 70 and 66 is like on another planet. So I'm sorry, but I'm the curmudgeon on this one, I guess.
Okay. All right. Mark A. Simon says on Twitter, Mark Simon, Sports Info Solutions. Let's take one very quick one here. And been talking with me for a number of weeks now about the top 10 San Francisco Giants hitters. Let's stick just with the hitters for a second. For wins above replacement, which, of course, is a huge statistical marker for a player now. So this is all-time top 10 San Francisco Giant hitters for WAR, as they say. Any surprises in there?
Yeah, there were a couple. I wanted to do this because I felt like it would blend your world with my world pretty well. The obvious ones are at the top. It's kind of like it is how it should be. Mays, Bonds, McCovey, Posey are your top four. Bobby Bonds is five. Then you get Will Clark, six. I don't think people would contest that much. Matt Williams is seven. I'm going to skip eight for a second. Jeff Kent, nine. And then Jack Clark and Orlando Cepeda are, like, just about even for that 10 spot. It's a hard one. It's one where you're like, afterwards it makes sense, but it's not like Crawford, it's not Belt, it's Robbie Thompson, who rates ahead of Jeff Kent, which I thought was interesting. But Robbie Thompson did play 11 seasons, and he was a middle infielder at a time when middle infielders didn't necessarily hit a lot, and he played good defense, and he had longevity. So he winds up eight in this because, again, when you think about it, if Robbie Thompson hadn't been there and you just plugged in a mediocre minor leaguer to replace him, you wouldn't get very much. With Robbie Thompson there, you were getting decent value. So that's why he winds up eight. When I saw that one, I said, well, that's the one that people would, like, talk about if they saw it. And I thought that was kind of interesting.
All right, very, very interesting. I got to meet Robbie. We did one of our trips, seems like years ago, in December, down to Cabo San Lucas, and he was on the trip with a number of Giants vacation people, and I was lucky enough to go on that one. Super guy. Yeah, and I could see.
He became a coach.
Yeah, I could see what kind of a competitor he is today and what he was then. And, he was. Look, I remember he had a big home run in the playoffs in 89 against the Cubs. I remember that.
Yeah, I do want to say, too, that Orlando Cepeda being low is a little bit odd. Like, you would have thought that Orlando Cepeda would have been, like, fifth or sixth. One, I guess there's not a huge difference between, like, five and six and 10 and 11. But first baseman, you have to be a extraordinary first baseman to do well in wins above replacement because there are so many good first basemen out there. So he doesn't necessarily do as well as you would think. And I don't necessarily think that takes anything away from him as a player. It just it just kind of shows you that, like, that certain positions are easier to replace, first base being the primary one, than others.
That's a good point. I hadn't thought about that. You always come up with something, and I say, boy, that's a good point. So first base, of course, is probably a little bit easier to replace. All right, very good. Hey, Mark, always good. This is a lot of fun tonight. I appreciate your insight and everything. And stay safe, and hopefully next Saturday we'll have something to talk about other than maybe there'll be a season. Maybe we'll know what's cooking. The Players Union, they have rejected formally the last offer. So, Rob Manfred, you work for the owners. The ball is in your court. Let's end it now.
Get it to 68 games, 12 against your division, 4 against your interleague opposite division. That's 68, 48 and 20. 68 gives you somewhat legitimacy, 40% of the season. Let's do it. Come on.
Okay. All right. All right. Mark, thanks so much. Have a good night.
Yeah, you got it.
All right. That is Mark Simon. Mark A. Simon says on Twitter. Always a lot of fun to talk some ball with him. All right. More coming up. KBR 680, 104.5, the sports leader.